There we go. So welcome to the Saturday morning call. This is Friday evening in the U.S. and probably someplace in the middle of the night in Europe. So, Corey, you're in New Zealand. What time is it for you?
It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, today we're going to be talking about boundaries, and that we can finish the topic right away with a few statements. And the first thing to say is that boundaries are fluid. Boundaries are changeable. Boundaries are not fixed, and they're not one point. Let us say even the boundaries of on the road, you have yellow lines and things like that. Those boundaries are actually a couple of inches wide. They're big enough to be seen. And that often in the practice of the Dhamma, or let us say in spiritual practices in particular, people are trying to find where the boundaries are. And then, in fact, they're kind of hard to find. Sometimes they don't even exist. And that from childhood, we have been, let us say, educated toward boundaries in the sense of this is yours, this is mine, this is your room, these are your toys, those toys don't belong to you, and other things like that. And so the boundaries that we are set up in childhood then become the same kind of boundaries that we look at in adult life. And that one of the things that we can then gain from this is to respect other people in their delusions of boundaries. Because they think that there are boundaries there, that if you cross their boundaries, they'll feel bad. And generally, there is no boundaries in existence, except that what humans make up. Now, basically, there's a thing that we can have, or a concept that we can call barriers, and that barriers are often used as boundaries. And what I say barriers means that they're difficult or take time or hard to cross. An example would be a tree that falls across the road, and it's hard to pass by that tree, and yet that tree is not seen by most people as a boundary. It's just an obstacle in the way. But rivers, mountains, oceans, and other things like that that are obstacles in the way now become natural boundaries. The example would be also we can start to look at the word border. Because a border is, let us call it a governmental or an official idea of what is a boundary, and that they often find barriers to use. Mountain ranges would be a good example. There's the border between Thailand and Malaysia is a series of mountains, and then at the very southern part, it's a river. And yet, for the local people, it's not a border. It's not really a boundary. It's just a barrier. And if you're willing to cross the barrier, there's no border there. And so there's a fluid movement back and forth between Malaysia and Thailand, simply because no one's guarding the borders. That the boundaries don't really exist except in the form of barriers. Now, let's look at that in more close detail, and that is, where does your body end and where does non-body start? Because your physical body actually is not a fixed or a tiny little boundary or barrier, rather it's fluid, that because you're moving around, the space that your body is in, actually the boundaries and the barriers are moving, and they're also not fixed. And that as we practice, we begin to see these loosening of these boundaries that we thought were fixed. We thought that my hand ends where, let us say, the glove begins. But in fact, once you get used to wearing the gloves, the outside of the glove is now the boundary for your hand, not the inside of the glove. And so things change. They move around. And the same thing is true with other parts of the human being, including the way that the mind works. The eyes, for instance, take in and receive data, but the data that is received has to do with three primary properties: color, shape, and movement. That in fact, movement is a basic and important thing. That if you are staring at something, then you will miss a lot of the movement around you. But if you have an open gaze, then anything that moves can be seen, can be brought into it because of the way that the eye works. And so once we take in data from the eye, can we leave it as just data in the sense that the eye is receiving input from the reality around us? Are we part of that reality? And the answer to that is, it depends upon our openness, that the more open we are, then the more fluid the boundaries are. And that by practicing, we can come out of the delusion of solid fixed boundaries and also come out of the delusion of I am this. I am the body. That in fact, there is a whole lot of big business and industries that kind of count on people making that delusion. An example of that would be the fashion industry, Gucci bags, the cosmetic industry. People will paint their faces thinking that the paint is more beautiful than the face, and that the face is the indication of me. And so by putting makeup on, people think that, or certain people think that they're more beautiful because the paint is there. That in fact, that's one of the things that you can start to practice, is to looking at people and see how many of them are wearing paint. They paint themselves. They tattoo themselves. They wear lipstick, eyeliner, all kinds of things like that to try to beautify the body, to enhance the beauty of the body, because they're confused in the sense of I am the body. And when we kind of begin to recognize that, well, I'm not really the body at all, then, well, if I'm not the body, then what am I? Well, here's one way of looking at it, is that it depends upon the speed of things. The body changes slowly over time, but you cannot make the body 10 years old today and 40 years old tomorrow. It can't happen that way. That the body actually is the boss of the body. Jesus said it in the way that you can't change your stature one whit. You can't control the body the way that we would like to control the body. And yet look at the amount of effort that people put into it. Weightlifting, calisthenics, exercises, medications, pills, diet, clothing. It goes on and on and on with under the delusion that I am the body. And yet the body is going to kind of do what it wants to do on all on its own. But the body generally changes slowly. And because it changes slowly, we kind of get the idea that I am the body. But reflect upon this for a moment. Recognize that at one time, each of you was a child. If you can remember back to the time that you were 5 or 6 years old, you can recollect that the body that you had then is nothing like the body that you've got now. And yet we identified with I am this body at the age of 6, and now we're identifying it as an adult, and the body is completely different, and we didn't have very much to do with that. And then, in fact, many of the things that people do to the body, trying to make it better, they actually put it in danger. This is actually becoming more well known, but I knew about it in the 1960s. There was a book that came out that became very popular. It was quite a fad, and the book was on jogging. You probably heard that word before. It's a kind of running. And after the book came out, then it became public knowledge that the guy who wrote the book and was the king of jogging, he had knee trouble. And then he died of a heart attack. And that it can the dangers can be traced back to the body, the jogging that he was doing. And that you can see people doing, for instance, bodybuilding. And those bodybuilders, actually, they use steroids and they pump themselves up and things like that. And then they don't live for very long. In fact, the less you try to do with the body, the easier the body is going to have, and therefore it's probably going to last much longer. Another example, in calisthenics, that the young girls that they would train in China, China really, really wanted to win the Olympics with these calisthenics, they're having the girls jump around on bars and poles and things like this. And it came to find out that the ones who were in deep physical training for that wound up having arthritis and other physical ailments, even in their 20s, that they overworked, they overabused the body, trying to make it do something. So the body, in fact, does not belong to you. It is not yours. It's a natural thing. As best we can understand is that we're a host, that we're a guest in the body. But then we can recognize that, wait a minute, there are other things that change much more rapidly than the body. An example of that would be emotions. That emotions actually change much more frequently. That you can get angry and stay angry for a few days, but you're not going to stay angry for your entire life. Even those who are prone to anger will be not angry for most of the time. And then a split second and something will happen and they can become angry and have to deal with the anger. So also you can begin to note how you feel, because how you feel is changing. It's changing on a regular basis. It's not changing, let us say, constantly, but in a way it is. Even anger has degrees. And generally, anger is, let us say, kicked off by thoughts. And that our emotions are directly related to the body, in the sense that the mind will have a particular kind of thought. It will release certain kind of chemicals in the glands, the pituitary and the pineal gland that are behind the inside of the skull, in the back. And those communicate with the glands throughout the body, especially the adrenal gland, which is in the lower back. And then the adrenal gland will release adrenaline or cortisol. And so the mind actually conditions the body, but it doesn't particularly control it. That's one of the points that we have to make about the teaching of the Buddha, that when we say cause and effect, oftentimes the cause is not a cause, it's a conditioning. An example of that would be a catalytic converter. Catalytic converters do not cause, let us say, the heavy-duty pollutions to change their chemistry, that it conditions it to do that. And so our conditioning then is one of the things that we can say is that's how the boundaries are crossed, that the way you feel and the body itself, they condition each other. The boundaries are not strong. The chemicals that we have in the body. And oftentimes, there's more to it than that, that the emotions will also condition the mind. A good example of that is in sports, if you can get a member of the opposite team really angry, he can't play as well. This is a well-known point in chess. Back in 1972, Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer, an American, had the World Chess Championship, and Boris Spassky was the champion of Russia already. He had already, in fact, won the World Championship. He was the better player, but he was always playing with people who were there to play chess. And Bobby Fischer wasn't there to play chess. He was there to play psychological games. And so he would do things that would disrupt Boris Spassky's thought process. An example of one of the things that Bobby Fischer would do would be hovering his hand over a particular piece on the chessboard. Now, he wouldn't touch it, because if you touch it, according to the rules, you've got to move it. But he would not touch it. He would just hover his hand over it as if he were holding it, but it wouldn't quite touch. And then he would move another piece. Another thing that he would do is that when it wasn't his move, he would stand up and walk around, and generally he would walk to the back of Spassky and look at the chessboard over his shoulder, which would greatly disrupt Boris Spassky's thought pattern. In fact, I saw that in the 2016 presidential election, to where when Hillary Clinton was talking, Donald Trump would stalk her. He would follow her around, hover over her, make her bring out she was afraid of him. And because of that, she couldn't focus on what she was going to say. Another example of this is in debate. They have the quality of ad hominem attacks, that you're only supposed to attack the guy's topic, not him. And so that's a fluid boundary. It's kind of easy to get away with attacking someone because you associate them with the topic that they're talking about. And so by attacking the topic personally, you can actually have a personal attack. So this is actually an indication that the way that we feel actually conditions the way we think. The body conditions the feelings condition the mind, the states of mind condition the kind of thoughts that we're having. For instance, if you are angry, then the kind of thoughts that you're going to have are going to be within a certain range. Now, one of the qualities of Anapanasati is to start looking not at the body as a body, or the feelings as feelings, or the mind state as a mind state, or the mind objects as mind objects, but rather to see the connections between them, that the boundaries are, let us say, fluid, just like a rainbow. that in fact, in the really, really old days, when the artists would do renderings of rainbows, they didn't show all seven colors. And then in fact, it's hard to even see seven colors. In fact, indigo and violet for most people are just blue. And also, the colors merge and mix, that it's actually the colors of the rainbow are not the colors in the rainbow, they're the colors that the eye can see. So the distinction between orange and yellow is something that the eyes are picking up. The distinction between green and blue are actually part of the eye conception. And at one time, it looks like that humanity didn't take much notice between the color blue and the color green, partly because there are no real blue objects in nature. The children are taught, in fact, to distinguish blue, that the natural is to just see green. That in fact, in the Pali language, this is where this comes from. We know about the ancient languages in the Pali, they didn't make a distinction between blue and green, which is kind of funny because in modern translations, they were often translated as blue, when in fact the object was actually green in color. The exact point that I'm making there would be the casino. The blue casino is actually not blue, it's green. Why? Because of the color of the leaves. The blue casino is actually made out of leaves, which are green. So that meant that at one time, the boundary between green and blue did not exist as strongly as it does in modern society. Also, the rainbow colors did not exist strong in the ancient societies. That it wasn't until prisms were not invented but discovered that the real rainbow and the whole spectrum of colors could be seen and identified. Only then were humans then taught about seven colors in the rainbow. I remember when I was in grade school, we had Roy G. Biv. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, right? But in the old days, people didn't make those kind of distinctions. So what we're actually doing now with Anapanasati is beginning to investigate the kind of distinctions like this, like how does the mind condition the feelings? How do the feelings condition the mind? What is the distinctions in there? What do you feel? Now, the next point is that we have allowed the mind to condition the feelings without even knowing that that's what's going on. That in our language, we define ourselves as a feeling, just like we talked about humans defining themselves as their body. They also define themselves as a feeling. For instance, I am frustrated, I am angry, I am pissed off. And that identifies the person with the feelings. And a much better way to say it is, oh, the body is conditioned in such a way that it is perceived to be angry. Now, what are the actual conditionings of the body that we perceive as anger? One of them would be clenched fist, a tight face, getting the neck is red and swollen, the way that the arms move, the voice gets loud, other things like this we can detect as anger, and that when someone is angry, another person is actually keen on seeing these changes, but the guy who is actually in that body changing those feelings is likely to miss it. So you can walk into a bar and see a bar scene, a bar fight, and these guys are really screaming at each other, and we can say, settle down, don't be so angry, and they'll turn and say, I'm not angry. Well, of course he's angry. He just doesn't recognize it. But when we practice Anapanasati, one of the important things is to begin to see how we feel. to see if we like things or not like things or are confused or whatever like this. Now, the teaching that I'm talking about right now is actually Paticca-samuppada or dependent origination. And the important place in that is when our perception of things contacts us in order for feelings to rise. Now, it's important for you to recognize is that what you see does not condition us. What you hear does not condition us. It goes through a process of perception. And then the outcome of the perception, our internal understanding, is what then conditions our feelings. And you can see that people are out of control with their feelings quite often. That in fact, it looks like that the police in certain countries are conditioned towards anger, especially, let us say, the United States, to where the police in Thailand are not conditioned towards anger. And that anger, by the way, is conditioned not upon anger per se as it is, but the anger is conditioned by fear, that fear is the primary human emotion, and that most of all of our side emotions are expressed through fear. For instance, the cop would be afraid that his authority is being challenged. And because of that, he acts in an angry way. And that when people see the cop acting angrily, they become afraid, and so they respond with anger. When you become angry, the best thing to do is to recognize that that anger is coming from fear. Look at what it is that you're afraid of. Yes, Michael, go ahead.
I wasn't going to say anything.
You indicated that you were.
Oh, sorry.
Like you started to say something, so I thought I'd...
I was just getting...
Yes, Corey, go ahead.
I was just thinking what you were saying in regards to the body. Is this potentially why they come up with the practice of the 32 parts of the body to try and get away from that attachment to the body, or?
Yes, that in fact, that's an old, old way of looking at the body, that everyone looked at it like that. But that, in fact, I have seen Western meditators try to meditate on kidneys or meditate on bowels. And this is not what they were talking about in those suttas, that bag of beans there's not a kidney bean or a bowel bean or an eye bean or any of that kind of stuff, but rather to gain familiarity with your body. An example of that would be starting to watch what your hands are doing. That oftentimes our arms are akimbo, we're moving a lot, and it depends upon the culture that we're in. In fact, that it's quite well known that Italians can't talk without moving their hands. They're just always talking and moving their hands back and forth like this, right? Because that's culture. They taught their children to speak by using their hands, and in fact, it's not sign language, it's random gestures. And yet other people get into a particular thing. An example of that is when Donald Trump is talking, he often moves his hands back and forth like this. Now, we can see several things in that. One of the things is that his boundaries are fluid. He's moving them back and forth. Which is also another way to say it is that when he's doing his hands like this, more than likely he's lying. So we can actually tell the gestures. Also, we can look at facial movements, and that is good to begin to feel what your face is doing. For instance, are you knitting your brow? Are you raising your eyebrows? Can you begin to control your facial movements? This is a point that we're making is that you are not the body, but you're the boss. You're the guest. Like the famous or the rich hotel guest, that the whole hotel and everything about it bends and leans towards taking care of the royal guest. Right? So you're the royal guest in the body, but you don't own the body. You don't have to clean the floors. You don't have to put siding up on the hotel. The hotel staff or the hotel people, or the, in your case, the body itself, will take care of the body. It'll give you messages and things like this. So the point is that if we start to look at what the body is doing, this is actually what Goenka was talking about in body scanning. He wanted the people to get used to looking at what their body was doing, but the body scanning is a very formal way of doing it, and most of the people who are practicing that body scanning actually are not doing it when they need to do it. That looking at the body is better done when we're not sitting in meditation. But in fact, it's what we're doing throughout the day. We're grasping, reaching, touching, setting things down, all kinds of stuff. Notice when we're scratching. Notice when we're picking our nose or when we're looking at the body. Whatever we're doing, pay a close attention to this is what your hands are doing with the body. All right. So the next point then is to start to see how the mind states are conditioned by the feelings and how the feelings condition the mind states. Just like the point about Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer was is that Bobby Fischer was actually able to condition Boris Spassky's mental state so that he couldn't think properly about the chess moves. We do this to ourselves. We put ourselves in a position to where we can't think properly. An example would be that currently I'm working on a website, and when this website does something strange, fear comes up, and when the fear comes up, then I can't do it properly. I'm afraid. So by managing the fear and taking the fear away, now I can think my way through things and see what's going on and making a fix. But while we're afraid, we can't think straight. And yet most people will spend a lot of time in fear. Good example of this is be road rage that you can see on the YouTube internet shorts about how much road rage actually causes accidents because people can't think straight when they're afraid of another driver and they feel disrespected, and so anger comes up. People can't stay in the state of fear. Because in a mindful state of fear would mean to just get away from the other driver. Slow down. Park. Stay on the side of the road. Let the guy go. But in fact, what will happen with ordinary people is that fear will be converted into anger. And then the anger conditions their ability to drive. And so they wind up having a great deal of difficulty, all because they're not watching what they're doing. So Anapanasati actually is a very, very excellent way to start to living an easy life because it's not dangerous anymore, because you're not doing things ignorantly, because you're not watching your feelings. This is where we can really gain great benefit from Anapanasati practice is to start looking at the way that we feel initially, that in fact, if you can see the fear as it arises, then you'll almost never get angry, or the anger will dissipate very quickly. But if you're not aware that all your anger is conditioned by fear, then the anger can take control. And then we make statements like, I am frustrated. I am angry. In fact, no, it's not you. That's just the body's conditioning, the feeling conditioning of the body's response to certain chemicals that were conditioned by the brain or the mind. And so if we can then begin to see how the body conditions the feelings condition the mind conditions the mind's thoughts, then we can reverse that also, so that the thoughts that you have can condition the mind state can condition the way that we feel, and the feeling can then condition the body. And it's even more complicated than that, that the mind states can condition the body directly. And so there's let us say, a mixed bag. Things are interdependent. The boundaries are not hard. They're very soft, subtle. Actually, where your skin boundaries are is soft and subtle. For instance, you can hold a match close to your hand and feel the heat from it. The burning match doesn't have to touch the skin. Just getting it close is enough for you to experience the heat. So where does the boundaries of the body then actually exist? One of the techniques to actually experiment with this is in the hand mudras that they talk about in meditation. Okay. One of the hand mudras you've seen is this one. Have you ever seen this one? There's pictures of it all kinds of places, okay? The question is, what's the difference in the distance? Let's see if I can find, there we go. The distance in the fingers. Find a place, all right. When do they touch? Actually, when does the finger when and the thumb actually touch? Can you experience the touch of the finger from the thumb and the thumb from the finger before they actually touch? How far is the distance? Is it 1 millimeter? Is it 2 millimeters? Is it an inch? That in fact, this is something that we can begin to understand is that things don't have to touch the body to condition the body. This is actually what is considered, in some respects, psychic. That people can feel things, they can pick up stuff. An example of that is you can pick up, if you're watching what's going on, if you're paying attention to the body, then you can feel all kinds of things that most people don't ever, and only you can do it when you're really paying close attention. An example of that would be the barometric pressure. What's the pressure of the air on you? How much humidity is in the air? What's the temperature of the air? What's the movement of the air? Because in fact, the air around the body conditions and has influence on the body. So in that case, where does the body stop and the air begin? Where is the boundary? The boundaries are actually fluid. And with perception, with actually paying attention to the sense of touch, you can begin to feel all kinds of things that you weren't able to feel before because we weren't paying attention to the body. We were, in fact, paying attention to or not paying attention to much of anything, or paying attention to the mind. But as we practice Anapanasati, we begin to see that you can actually condition the mind with your thoughts to change your attitude, and then the thoughts and the attitudes can change the way you feel. Also, the way the body is, this is one of the reasons why the Buddha refers to seclusion often, to get away from other people, to get into a secluded situation so that the body can feel safe. If the body can feel safe and secure, and you have the thoughts of being safe and secure, then the attitude of the mind, the state of mind, will change into being safe and secure, and then we can begin to feel safe and secure. Now, this is an important point in Anapanasati practice, is to actually learn to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel like everything is okay, everything is all right, not a problem in the world. Doesn't matter what goes wrong, it's not me that goes wrong. The database can go wrong, the car can go wrong, the house can break, the plumbing can break, the computer can malfunction, but it's not me. And yet when all of those kind of things happen, most people become afraid. When the car breaks down, we become afraid. Oh, we need that car, we have the thoughts. And the actual fact is you don't need a car. I mean, humanity ran just fine for centuries and millennia without cars, so we can live without cars, and yet we panic. Oh, I've got to go to work. Well, guess what? People lived for millennia without having paychecks and jobs. That's the funny thing is that if you look at time over a long period of time, you can recognize that the kind of stuff that you think that you need now is actually something that you've been conditioned to thinking that you need, for in fact, you don't need those things at all. May be convenient, but we don't need stuff. And so we can actually practice getting into a position, getting into seclusion. We can begin to practice that you don't need anything. The only thing that you really need is the air. And it's unlikely for that to be taken away from you. And that's all you need right now, is to keep breathing. So let's watch the breathing, because that's the only thing that you actually need. Take a deep breath and relax. Take a deep breath and just watch what's going on. And as we do, because we've already gotten into seclusion, we're not around any problems, then we can begin to feel like there are not any problems. We can condition the mind so that the mind has got no problems on the mind. And by doing that, we can condition the mind by our thoughts, we can condition the mind by our body, and then the mind's condition will begin to condition the way that we feel, so that we can wind up feeling easy, safe, secure, comfortable. But we need to practice this over and over again, because as soon as you leave your secluded place and go off into the world, all of that fear and turmoil of the world comes right back up again. And so we need to continue to practice feeling safe, comfortable, secure, easy. Life is easy. Pay attention to the reality is that you don't need anything. That's real. All we need is to keep breathing. Everything else is unnecessary right now. Michael, do you have any comments?
This was very well put, Damarado. Thank you so much. And in particular, you know, I heard Damavidu talk about looking at sort of the body of the breath whenever we're practicing Anapanasati for step three. And I feel like you've done a really good job of like showing how that body is just like ever changing. And, you know, it depends upon how aware we are to it and how much effort we put into looking at it.
Yes. Now, there's a question about what is the body of breath. We have someone called guest user. What's your name? Yes, you, the one in the striped shirt. You're still muted. Can you turn your mic on?
My name's Tom. I'm new to the group.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you very
much. Hope you can put the name Tom on your Skype account so that we'll know who you are.
I will.
Okay. So, the body of breath actually, or the breath body is a better way of talking about it, is from the lower abdomen up into the top of the head, because that's the area that's actually affected by and is part of the breathing process. And so the breath body, and you can then say, well, the body of breath then means is that that's just another way of looking at it, but now we're looking at the air, the breath itself. So as you exhale, you actually are changing the environment. You're changing the way that the environment smells. You're changing the way that the environment is affected by temperature. A really easy way for you to understand that is by getting in bed and getting completely covered up so that you're completely working with only the air that you've already been circulating through the body. You'll find out that the body actually conditions the air a lot. The body breathing conditions the air, the makeup of the chemistry of the air. That if we're in an area where the wind is blowing, then the conditioning that we place upon the air gets moved off very easily with the wind. And then we have another breath of fresh air. But breathing the same air over and over again is why we call it stale. Why does the air get stale? Is because we staled it with our breathing. Carbon dioxide, molecules of broken up amino acids. Then, in fact, this is one of the easy ways of dealing with anger is by starting to breathe. If we breathe in and out, in a really good long exhale, then that will actually remove the chemicals of the anger from the body. It's also an important point to remember that anger is just merely a chemical conditioning of the body. But that chemical conditioning of the body drains all of the good part of the blood out of the mind or out of the head into the body. So that we don't have, if we're angry, we don't have much blood to do a whole lot of thinking with. The same thing happens when we get cold. That when we're cold, it drains the blood out of the body. This is one of the reasons why it's easier to go to sleep when the temperature goes down. But if we in, let us say, hot weather, we're under a blanket, then that doesn't do it. And so the likelihood of us going to sleep is affected by that sort of thing. This is the kind of stuff that we want to start paying attention to, as to how these various boundaries are loose because of the way that things are conditioned and changing. And that you can have a major positive influence on this. This is back to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path, is that when you recognize that the kind of thoughts that you're having are unwholesome, change them to wholesome thoughts, because those wholesome thought changes will begin to change your attitude and then begin to change the way that you feel. Also, we need to have the body in a relaxed, safe, comfortable position, because if the body is safe, secure, and comfortable, then the mind can become safe, secure, and comfortable, and then the feelings can become safe, secure, and comfortable, and then we're only just a short step away from satisfaction. And it's important to point out that the teaching of the Buddha is not about high mystical experiences. It's not about what happens at particular points in time. It's more of how is the mind being conditioned over the long haul, over a long period of time. Can you begin to take the fear out of your life, bring joy into your thoughts? bring joy into the way that you feel. That in fact, a lot of people in the West, they mistake a particular experience as something that indicates something. Oh, well, I had a great big whoop-to-do experience and now I'm a soda pond. That's not true at all. The word soda pond actually means that it depends upon your attitude and the attitude of being, let's say, eager to hear the Dhamma, wanting to hear the Dhamma, immersing yourself into the Dhamma, and gaining great joy from hearing the Dhamma. That's what makes one a soda pond, not that they had some silly experience. And the worst part of it is that once we have that peak kind of experience, we want it again. Now we're in a state of desire. If we didn't have that state, that experience, we're okay. But now that we've had it, we want it again. Now we're in a state of wanting something that we don't have. We're actually creating more dukkha with these peak experiences than we are by not having them. That what we really want to create is a sense of well-being that can be brought up, applied, and then sustained. As sustaining a sense of well-being, sustaining a sense of everything is okay. Whatever it is, we'll work it out. No problems, no worries. We're all in this state okay. Not a worry in the world. We need to apply and sustain this instead of looking for peak experiences in meditation. Also, the last point about that is that peak experiences, people want those things as if they've attained something. The reality is that what we're actually doing with the practice of the teaching of the Buddha is to lose things. It's a dead loss. But what are we losing? We're losing sadness, anger, frustration, and mostly a sense of fear. Lose your fear. Drop it away. Live as if there are no problems and everything is safe and secure. This is the attitude that we're going to develop that's going to be valuable over the long haul. Moment by moment by moment, I'm safe. Moment by moment by moment, I'm secure. Moment by moment by moment, I'm comfortable. Moment by moment, moment after moment, I'm satisfied. Everything's okay. Everything's good. Got no problems at all. When we are living our life like that, when everything is safe, secure, and comfortable, guess what? The boundaries that we used to think about and consider, they kind of float away. That almost always boundaries, barriers, and borders are developed mentally in order to manage or reduce fear. But if you are in a state of where you have no fear, that you're feeling safe, secure, comfortable, then your boundaries and your borders don't exist so much anymore. Then, in fact, the only reason now for you to be considering boundaries, barriers, and borders is because other people who feel unsafe and insecure, they don't like it when you break their boundaries, when you cross their borders, when you set up barriers for them. And so this is also mindfulness in the sense of we become mindful of not causing ourselves any troubles, any worries, any problems, and we also don't create any troubles or problems for other people so that you can help them feel safe, secure, comfortable, and satisfied. And this is really what the Buddha teaches. He does not teach high peak experiences. He doesn't teach to become special. What he teaches is to become boss of your own reality. Why? Because you're actually in reality. And the closer you are to actual reality, then the better off you are. To where most people, they want to create a reality that they can be safe in. instead of being actually safe in the real reality that surrounds them to the point that there's basically no boundaries or borders between you and reality, that you become reality, that we stop setting up the borders and boundaries between ourselves and reality. So this is the practice. The practice is to become safe, secure, and comfortable so that the boundaries, the borders can relax. So, Corey, do you have anything to say about this?
When you always say it like that, Damarado, it seems very simple. It's just the consistent practice of it, I think.
Yes, we have to keep applying it and sustaining it over and over again, because the natural tendency is to go back creating boundaries and borders to protect ourselves so that we could feel safe and secure. But if you already have control over your feelings of safe and secure, then we don't have to create these boundaries, these barriers anymore. So, Tom, what do you think? You come late, but has this been any value for you?
Yeah, sorry I came late. This is my first time with a group.
Well, give me a call.
I will.
Yeah, tomorrow or sometime.
I will. Thank you. Yeah, I'm very curious about the teaching. When I went to Thailand a couple times, I visited temples and I've gone to other Dhamma talks in my local area, but your teaching seems to resonate with me.
Yes, the real teaching of the Buddha resonates with everybody who hears it. Why? Because it's talking about what's real. The reality of the situation. A lot of people who come to Buddhism either bring with them or find all kinds of magical beliefs.
I guess lately, because I've read a lot of books on different traditions, non-duality or Advaita or Zen, but lately, or I would say in the past year, just that's starting to feel like it's falling away. That I'm reading so many books, but the information feels like it's an overload of information.
Yes, I would strongly recommend that you start spending time reading just one book and read it over and over again. And which book is that? The one between your ears, the one inside your skin. That's the book to read, to start looking at how you thought, what kind of thoughts you have, to see how your thoughts condition the mental processes, begin to change your attitude. And in fact, all people are born with the attitude of being a victim. We need to be taken care of. When we're little children, that attitude of being the victim is promoted. Children are taught that they've got to do what they're told to do. You got to go to school, you got to learn, you got to do this and that. And so when we're adults, we continue with that mental state of being a victim. Well, there's a duality built into there, because the victim is the one who feels afraid of the outside world. If you can come to the point of being safe and secure wherever you go, then that means that you're kind of merging with your environment rather than setting up boundaries. That they, in the old languages, they talk about duality and non-duality. This is actually what we're getting at, but I'm using a different language so that people can understand it, that we actually create the boundaries with our fear. And when you have no fear, then there are no reasons for any boundaries, and you can start to live a life naturally, comfortably, and easily. And so you can begin to condition the mind to have the attitude of being a winner, to being the boss, to being the emperor of your own pile of dirt. And that will then condition the feelings to feel safe and secure and comfortable. And then we can become satisfied. If you're satisfied with reality, then you're part of reality. There's no more boundaries there. But if you don't like something the way that it actually is, then you're the one who is creating the distance. You're the one who's creating the boundary. You're the one who's creating the duality. So I've forgotten your name again. What was it? The one that
Slava.
Lava?
Slava.
Okay.
Yeah, the full name is Vyacheslav. It's like Vyacheslav Petisov. Do you remember this hockey player from USSR?
So what do you think about what we're talking about the boundaries? You were asking about boundaries.
Yeah, I think about this like more from experiential perspective, not like a conceptual perspective. So in my own experience, what I feel, and when I try to... So this question is basically like after some time I start to spontaneously get into this space when I don't have like boundaries and everything feel is the same of importance, like there is no important my thoughts or like my body and external less important things. And I found that when I investigate like where is my boundaries and what is the difference between external events like in my awareness, like in internal events, or like where is my center of awareness? Like if it's like in my head or if it's moving in my chest, like when it's like moving the here and there.
And when you go looking for it, you're moving it around.
Yeah, it's moving and dissipates completely. And my question is basically like, do we need to play with in this space, or it's like just sidetrack us from actual practice?
Well, it depends upon the way that we're using the language, but I'm a big fan of playing with things, which means investigating them, looking at really what's going on, to start paying attention to all four aspects of ourselves, our lives. Start paying attention to the body, its movements, its interaction with the air. Pay attention to the mind states and how that's conditioned by our feelings. Start to look at the feelings themselves and see how they're conditioned by the mind states and by the body. Start looking at not these four items in particular, each one, because that's kind of a dualistic way of doing it, but instead look at the interconnections between them. That's much more of a holistic way of looking at it. So begin to look at your system as a holistic, where everything is interconnected and everything is interacting with one another. Begin to see that, in fact, you can, with your mind states, condition the way that you feel, that you're not out of control. Hello, Daniel. You didn't have to call. You could just join.
Oh, I forgot it was the Sangha. Hello. Happy to join anyway.
So good to see you again, but you called about an hour late.
I already started 1 hour. Okay, well, I'm just listening.
Okay, so before we finish, does anybody have any last points? Corey, you have any last points to make or any comments?
Not today, Damarada. That was very good. Thank you.
All right. How about you, Tom?
No, but thank you very much.
How about you, Michael?
Lighten up and keep it real.
Mm-hmm. So, Anybody else? All right, well, let's go ahead and end this call. Let's put a big boundary between us.
Short but sweet. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. You new guys, give me a call sometime, and we'll talk about getting started in practice.
Thank you.
Thanks, Camarado.
Okay. Bye-bye.